Good morning. It's 11 minutes before the hour. You're listening to NPR's Morning Edition over Raven Radio, KCAW in Sitka, where it's 52 degrees under mostly cloudy skies. Today's Monday, July 30th, 2012. I'm Robert Woolsey with Raven News. An Air Station Sitka helicopter crew medevaced a cruise ship passenger in northern Chatham Strait on Thursday. The Norwegian Pearl was cruising 23 miles west of Juneau late Thursday afternoon when it notified the Coast Guard that a 53-year-old female aboard the ship was unconscious and unresponsive. Air Station Sitka launched a rescue helicopter shortly after 5 p.m., arriving on scene at about 5:30. The air crew successfully hoisted the patient and delivered her to waiting EMS personnel in Sitka. The woman was taken to Mount Edgecombe Hospital for further evaluation and treatment. New federal air pollution restrictions will affect crews and some other vessels sailing Alaska waters, but they will not affect state ferries. Captain Mike Newsell is the state's deputy commissioner of marine transportation.
It is a big issue for the state of Alaska. It is not necessarily a big issue for the Alaska Marine Highway System. All of our ships operate within 200 miles of the coastline, already burned low sulfur fuel.
State ferries made the switch a number of years ago before Newsell came on board. The new air emission limits come from the Federal Environmental Protection Agency. They apply to what are called emission control areas, or ECAs. Officials say they're part of an international effort to lower pollution that contributes to human illnesses and deaths. Newsell says the required fuel is already available at ferry ports.
The suppliers there already carry ultra-low sulfur diesel because that's what they have, that's what we use. So it wasn't a big switch, and the switch that the Marine Highways made was not in direct response to this upcoming implementation of the ECA.
The new rule will go into effect on Wednesday, August 1st. Alaskans flying out of Seattle-Tacoma International Airport will catch their flights at a renovated North Satellite building following a major renovation at the facility in the next few years. Alaska Airlines and the Port of Seattle this month announced the airline would soon be the sole tenant for the N gates, and they're going forward with a $230 million upgrade in that part of the terminal, Joe Vignicki reports.
People heading to Alaska on Alaska Airlines will be hopping aboard that underground train from either the C or D concourse and heading out to their end gates to catch flights in the future. It's part of a major renovation project that will have the majority of Alaska's planes moving to that North Satellite. Airport spokesperson Perry Cooper says a realignment of the airport's airlines will start up in 2013.
United will move off the North Satellite over to Concourse A, and Alaska will take over all the gates in the North Satellite. So it will really be an opportunity for them to kind of market it for their Alaska passengers, and then everyone that goes to the North Gate will end up being an Alaska passenger. They'll be able to put some of their finishes, that kind of thing, along with it so that you get to feel that kind of Alaska feel from the time you drive in on the north side of the ticketing level all the way through the passenger trains and then out to the North Satellite.
American, Frontier, Hawaiian, JetBlue, and Virgin America will also be switching locations at SeaTac next year to help accommodate those changes. The Port of Seattle Commission in July approved $32 million worth of design work, and that will prepare for major renovations of the 40-year-old North Satellite building that Alaska plans to take over. It's a partnership between the airline and the port. The construction costs will be shared between the two. Officials say the work is due and will improve the experience for Alaska's customers. Cooper says they'll be adding three end gates and making some other big changes to the North Satellite.
The biggest thing is there's going to be a new rooftop lounge for Alaska's passengers. We're going to refresh all the finishes, add some gates, potentially add some new stores and that kind of thing as well, too. And then from behind the scenes, it's going to be seismic upgrades, upgrading the HVAC system. So from a comfort level, it'll be much more comfortable than it is currently.
Alaska Airlines flies 2,700 people out of the airport to destinations in Alaska each day, according to airline spokesperson Bobby Egan.
This year, as we're celebrating our 80th anniversary, we look up north at our roots in the state of Alaska and are very much appreciative of our loyal customers who've been traveling on us for a number of years. So we're proud of that number and think that these renovations here in Seattle will make travel much easier and improved for our customers.
The airline already uses the North Satellite for a number of its flights. It will continue to use C or D gates for its commuter connections around the Pacific Northwest. However, Egan says consolidating flights mostly to that one part of the airport will make operations more efficient. Egan says the company considered public perceptions about the length of the walk from the counter to departure gate with the change.
We conducted 3 studies in recent years just examining that amount of time and the perception. And actually, what we learned is that it takes about the same amount of time to reach the North Satellite riding that train as it does to walk to the gates at the end of Concourse C.
She acknowledges that travelers will see some dust from the construction work once it starts up in 2014, but says the goal is to have the least amount of impact on customers. That work is scheduled for completion by the end of 2016. In Petersburg, I'm Joe Vicnicki.
2 major earthquakes last year raised red flags for seismically active parts of North America. Some of the damage in Japan and New Zealand resulted from a phenomenon called liquefaction, which turns the ground into jello like quicksand. Transmission towers topple, buildings sink, and utility pipes break. Now, geologists in the Pacific Northwest have mapped the spots most likely to liquefy in an earthquake. Northwest News Network correspondent Tom Bonsi begins the story in Japan.
This summer, the sound of hydraulic jacks reverberates through upscale neighborhoods near Tokyo Bay. Look closer, and you'll notice some of the homes here are tilted. We're in the suburb of Yuraisu, home of Tokyo Disneyland. This area escaped tsunami damage, but the district suffered major damage from soil liquefaction. Darren Chen of the Tokyo Institute of Technology explains what happened.
This soil liquefaction is due to the fact that you have high water table in this region.
Chen says much of Yuraisu is built on fill, its land reclaimed from the sea, making it prone to liquefaction.
And it usually occurs in fine sand deposits.
When the earth shook for minutes on end, water pushed upward under pressure. The ground turned to sludge or quicksand. Mini mud geysers erupted in the yard and street at 77-year-old Toru Kawahara's house. Well over a year after the quake, he's still cleaning up silt that flowed into his home's ground floor. Kawahara's house is structurally sound, but the whole thing settled off-kilter. The back corner is nearly 2 feet lower than the front. All over town, water and sewer connections broke. People had to use porta-potties for months after.
We knew that if an earthquake came, this area would be weak since it's a landfill. I used to work in the structural engineering industry, so I had some knowledge. If an earthquake were to come, this land probably wouldn't make it. But we didn't think this earthquake was big enough.
Kawahara's home is more than 200 miles away from the earthquake epicenter. It was the long duration of shaking, not its severity, that started the cascade of damage. The major population centers of the Pacific Northwest lie a similar distance from the likely origin of our big one. That's why a reconnaissance tour of liquefaction damage in Japan made a big impression on earthquake engineer Scott Ashford of Corvallis. Ashford is now interim dean of Oregon State University's College of Engineering.
For these large, you know, these magnitude 9 earthquakes, we can see liquefaction over area, you know, hundreds of square miles. And for us, that would mean, you know, as far as the I-5 corridor.
Ashford fears we could end up in far worse shape than Japan, since the Japanese prepare better for earthquakes than anyone. He says it's not a gap that can be fixed overnight. Ashford figures it will cost billions of dollars to strengthen all of the Northwest's vulnerable bridges, schools, fuel depots, fire stations, etc.
It's something that we can't just stick our head in the sand, right, and let it liquefy. What we got to do is just make, you know, understand where we are, accept that risk, and then slowly start mitigating and understand it's going to take a few decades to get where we need to be.
Step 1 is figuring out where the greatest vulnerabilities lie. Oregon, Idaho, and Washington have all received federal grants to map liquefaction susceptibility. The Idaho Geological Survey has posted such maps for the Boise area, Idaho Falls, Rexburg, and Teton County. Washington State has completed a statewide hazards map that's searchable online. In Oregon, the Department of Geology's chief scientist, Ian Maiden, has finished a similar digital statewide map and says it will go online soon.
So people will be able to go to this web map. They'll be able to type in their address. The map will fly them to their backyard. They'll be able to see their house. And then they can turn on, you know, the shaking hazard layer, or they can turn on the liquefaction potential.
In Oregon, the valley areas most prone to liquefaction also happen to have the highest concentrations of people and industry. But Maiden also says,
your house is not going to collapse and kill you because of earthquake shaking in most instances, simply because of the way that homes in the Pacific Northwest are constructed. Mm-hmm. So what people really need to think more about is their community. Mm-hmm. Where's their water supply coming from? Where's the fire station? Where are the critical facilities?
What Maiden's talking about is community resilience, the ability to bounce back quickly from natural disaster. Right now, committees of experts in both Oregon and Washington are drafting detailed recommendations for highways, utilities, fuel supply, and commerce. The planning process hasn't gotten much attention yet, but the final price tag for better preparedness likely will. Look for that this fall or winter. I'm Tom Bonsi reporting.
A consulting company has been hired to survey the exterior walls of Alaska's capital after chunks of the aging building fell to the ground. The Legislative Council last week approved up to $149,000 for the survey work. The council handles the day-to-day business of the legislature. Senator Dennis Egan, a Democrat from Juneau, says they need to make sure the building is safe. It could be several months before the legislature has a report on the survey. Sun weather forecast today for Sitka and Port Alexander calls for mostly cloudy skies, scattered showers, highs around 59, light winds becoming southwest 5 miles per hour in the late afternoon. Tomorrow, rain, highs around 56. This is Raven Radio, KCAW, in Sitka.